Reading for Ramadan.
In Reading for Ramadan, we're basically asking this question: what books, fiction or otherwise, capture the spirit of Ramadan for you? It's a question we're asking on Talking of Books because whether you're Muslim or non-Muslim, reading and reflection go hand in hand, which is fitting for this show. Rehan Khan is with us on the show today, regular moderator at the Emirates Airline Festival of Literature, an author of fiction, and most importantly for today's conversation, an avid reader who is observing Ramadan. Welcome to the show, Rehan.
Thank you.
We've had some varied choices for Ramadan reads so far. We've had Omar Saif Gobash's Letters to a Young Muslim. We've had The Alchemist by Paulo Coelho, Wander by R.J. Palacio, and we've, interestingly enough, had Tea Veg, a picture book about a vegetarian T-Rex by Smriti Prasadam Halls.
Interesting. I'm vegetarian, so that's, I should have recommended that one as well.
Yeah, you should have.
It's an excellent book.
It is excellent. It is excellent if anybody's looking for a picture book. So what books have you brought with you, and kind of what was your thinking behind the choices, first of all?
Yeah, so I've brought The Road to Mecca, which is a biography set in Arabia in the 1920s. And it's a book about transformation. I've also brought Revelation, which is the story of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. And once more, it's a book about transformation, transcendence. And then I've also brought Just Mercy by an American human rights lawyer, because it's about social justice, and justice and inequality are huge themes in Ramadan.
Well, starting with The Road to Mecca, give us a bit more information about that one and the author.
Yeah, sure. So The Road to Mecca is set in the 1920s. It's a biography in Arabia of the 20s. You can just imagine what it was like back then. And the author is Muhammad Asad, and he was born Leopold Weiss. He was born as a Jew in an Austro-Hungarian family. His father was a banker, his grandfather was a rabbi, and he grew up, became a journalist, and in the 1920s started traveling throughout Arabia. He becomes a Muslim in 1926 when he's actually speaking to someone in Afghanistan, and they say to him, well, you're defending Muslims, you know, you are a Muslim. And he's like, yeah, maybe I am. And then he converts to Islam. Anyway, from 1926 to 32, he spends time with Ibn Saud, who's the founder, obviously, of Saudi Arabia. And he undertook a number of missions for Ibn Saud, going out to various tribes, talking, negotiating. Obviously, he spoke about 8 languages, I think, including a lot of European languages, as well as Persian, Arabic, and a bunch of others. And it was during this period, I think, that the book is actually set during that time. And it's in Arabia, which, you know, it's not there today, basically, that type of Arabia at that point. It's not there. So he spends those years in Arabia, and then after that he goes off, he's invited to India by the poet-philosopher Muhammad Iqbal, who is one of the founders of Pakistan, to get involved in the Pakistan project, in the creation of Pakistan. During the war years, he's interned by the British, actually, in a prisoner of war camp because of his German connections. But anyway, in 1947, the Pakistanis give him citizenship, and he eventually becomes Pakistan's representative at the United Nations in 1947. And it's when he then comes back to the West in 47, about 23 years after he'd actually left, he was meeting a lot of Westerners who initially thought, well, he's obviously just some technocrat that the Easterners have hired. But then they realized, actually, no, he's actually a Muslim, and he's, you know, embraced the culture and speaks the language. And it was that curiosity that people were saying, well, why, you know, what compelled you to leave this very advanced Western civilization to go over to the East, to much more of a mystical kind of, you know, which was seen as a lesser kind of intellectual civilization. And that's what prompted him to write the book. So he wrote the book in the 50s as really that journey of why he went through that transformation.
He comes across as a bit of a daring adventurer, but does that come across in the book? Sometimes my worry with books like this is that you can get weighed down with the historical facts and the names and the data. But how do you think it reads?
Well, each chapter, I'd like to read from it in just a moment. Each chapter begins with some amazing prose. I mean, if he was if he was alive today, you would invite him to the literature festival. I mean, 100%. It's basically like reading Arundhati Roy at the start of every single, every single chapter. It's like starting with Arundhati Roy in terms of the prose and the richness of the language and so on. And he starts off like that. He sort of It's quite philosophical at certain points, talking about, you know, what's happened to him throughout his life, in a biography. So, for example, the second chapter starts with him down a well. He's just come off for a very long trip. He's boiling hot. He crawls down a well, cools himself down. And as he's cooling himself down, he's remembering his childhood in Austria, going to lakes and trips to Vienna, and thinking about that time, reflecting, coming back to the present. It's like really wonderfully written.
So you had a bit that you'd like to read. I'd love to hear the writing style. I really would. It sounds fascinating.
Okay, so let's read from the very opening. And this is, the chapter is called Thirst. I'll just read one paragraph. We ride, two men on two dromedaries. The sun flames over our heads. Everything is shimmer and glimmer and swimming light. Reddish and orange colored dunes behind dunes, beyond dunes, loneliness and burning silence, and two men on two dromedaries in that swinging gait which makes you sleepy so that you forget the day, the sun, the hot wind, and the long way. Tufts of yellow grass grow sparsely on the crests of the dunes, and here and there gnarled, hammed bushes wind over the sand like giant snakes. Sleepy have become the senses. You are rocking in the saddle. You perceive hardly anything beyond the crunching of the sand under the camel's soles and the rub of the saddle peg against the crook of your knee. Your face is wrapped in your headcloth for protection against sun and wind, and you feel as if you were carrying your own loneliness like a tangible substance across it, right across it, to the wells of Tamar, to the dark wells of Tamar that give water to him that is thirsty.
Oh, so atmospheric.
Very atmospheric.
Every chapter is like that.
I'm completely transported.
It's like, it's incredible. If you haven't read it, you definitely should read this.
Remind people listening of the title if they've just tuned in.
Yeah, so it's called The Road to Mecca by Muhammad Asad, and it was written in the 1950s. It was a huge bestseller at the time, and he's just not so well known now, but you know, if you look at his life, it's you know, he's a man. I mean, in 2008, outside the United Nations office in I think in Vienna, somewhere in Austria, he was outside Vienna, the United Nations office, the plaza was renamed Muhammad Asad Platz in recognition of his, you know, his work between, really as a bridge builder between the East and the West, and between the Muslim world and the non-Muslim world.
I am inspired to read it, and particularly for that reason, because he's someone who straddled worlds, so you feel you'll get insights that, you know, would be difficult for other people, you know?
Yeah.
Why is this a Ramadan read for you? Would you mind explaining that and kind of what Ramadan means to you?
Sure. So the book is a story of transformation from, you know, it's a biography, and every great biography, you know, you enjoy it when you can see the character, the protagonist, you know, going down that transformation. And there's a huge transformation taking place here in terms of his life, his culture, his intellectual thought process. And Ramadan is also, you know, I would approach it as a period of transformation to essentially better myself in whatever it might, my character, my conduct, my language, how I treat people, because, you know, there's in every Muslim household, there's often a conversation that, you know, that uncle was here last Ramadan and he's not here anymore, you know, or that great aunt was here last Ramadan, they're not here anymore. And it's almost like a reminder that how many of us are going to be here next Ramadan? You know, are we going to have that opportunity? Because, you know, we all know people who've passed away across the year, right? So are we going to be here? So use Ramadan for transformation. And the book is about transformation.
Oh, that's wonderful. I'm so glad that you brought this book. And I think this is the joy of this segment for me, is that I discover not only books like The Alchemist that I've heard of, but books like this as well, which I would never have come across in a million years.
Absolutely. Books and people that I'm constantly surprised that I have not heard of before. You know, you know, I'm so happy to discover this person, and I want to know more about him.
Yeah.
And what's the second book that you'd like to share with us?
The second book is Revelation, The Story of Muhammad by Dr. Miraj Mohideen. And he actually won the nonfiction prize at the Sharjah International Book Fair in 2016. It's a biography of the Prophet.
And tell us a little bit about the author as well. Do you know much about him?
Yeah, so he's actually a medical doctor, and he wrote the book because he said that, you know, all of the traditional biographies of the Prophet were really difficult to approach. And he's a non-Arabic speaker. And he said that he really felt at a bit of a distance from, because the Quran is in Arabic, and he, as a non-Arab speaker, it was very difficult to access it sometimes. So he thought, well, how can I access, you know, the river of my faith much more easily? Well, perhaps if I understand the life of the Prophet, what if I was one of the companions who were around the Prophet at this time, and if I could understand his character, I can understand the faith a lot better as well. So that's what really compelled him then to write a book, which is, it's written very much like a textbook, because he's a medical doctor himself, and so this particular biography is full of diagrams and maps and colours, and it's really easy to read.
I'm looking at it right now, and I have to be honest, it's not what I expected.
No.
At all.
It looks entirely like a textbook, in fact. Yeah. And does it read that way? Is it quite clinical, or do you find do you get into the depths of the story there?
Yeah, so look, if you look at sort of the life of the Prophet, you know, in a nutshell, you know, he was an orphan. He had some mentor figures around him, his grandfather who died early, his uncle died early, his wife died early. He then started to preach monotheism to his people in Medina, the Quraysh, the tribe of the Quraysh, and they drove him out. He went north to Yathrib, which is today known as Medina. The people pursued him. He had to overcome great adversity, and eventually he came back to Mecca towards the end of his life. And then when he was at this point where all the power was in his hand, and you know, his enemies were vanquished, you know, he essentially said to them, you know, I forgive you, right? And what I just kind of described is really anyone who's familiar with Joseph Campbell's The Hero with a Thousand Faces, you know, the hero's journey. That's essentially what I've just described. It's that heroic quest. And so what Dr. Miraj does in the book is that he takes that hero's quest, you know, the journey of the Prophet, and he builds a really interesting tool to understand it. And he says he divides a life of the Prophet up into a 24-hour clock. Okay, and he says that imagine year one is everything that happens to the Prophet before the first revelation comes. So the first revelation comes to him at the age of 40. So 1 o'clock is everything that's happened before. And the next 23 years, he's divided into a 24-hour clock with different things happening. So if you imagine a 24-hour clock, from 1 o'clock to, say, 6 o'clock on a 24-hour clock, that's the period, the early Meccan period, the time in Mecca when the Prophet was there. And it was a time where some of the initial verses of the Quran were revealed. And those particular verses spoke about monotheism. They spoke about taking care of people. They spoke about purification. They spoke about social justice. And the Meccan leadership were not happy with that. You know, they didn't like that at all because it was a very unjust society at the time. And so then from the 6 o'clock on the clock, and you can see the diagram here in front of me, mm-hmm. you know, the 6 o'clock to the 12 o'clock, imagine the Prophet's life, is the late Meccan period. So now now we start looking at what happens is that some of the kind of the stellar figures of the Meccan society also join the Prophet's cause. And this really upsets the Meccan leadership, and they start to discriminate the Muslim community a lot more. There's a lot more hardship. And eventually it results in, at essentially roughly around the 12 o'clock point on a 24-hour clock, it results in the Muslim community migrating in what's called the Hijra, and they go north to Yathrib, right? And in that period from 12 o'clock to 18 o'clock, is a period of great tribulation. There are many battles. There are three battles. One, the Muslims win, then they lose one, then they win one. And it's a period of great stress and tribulation. And again, the verses of the Quran that are being revealed at that time are around, you know, establishment of a new society, rules and regulations and those kind of things. And then from 1800 to the zero point is the late Medinan period, where the Prophet then is, you know, they sign something called the Treaty of Hudaybiyah, which establishes peace. The Muslim community can settle down, and then it's eventually his return back to Mecca. And so that hero's quest, if you like, that journey, by mapping it in this kind of really innovative way around 24-hour clock, makes the book so accessible. Because then I'm looking at the book and I'm thinking, okay, right, so at 11 o'clock is a period of real great sadness for the prophet because one of his mentors dies, his uncle dies, his wife dies straight at that point. He's feeling great sadness, remorse. And then if you look at what revelation God reveals to the prophet at that point, he reveals chapter 10 of the Quran, which is the story of Prophet Jonah. And the story of Jonah, as we know, Jonah preached to his people, they turned him away, he ended up in the belly of the whale. And the prophet, and God is essentially saying to the prophet, look, this prophetic path that you're on is a path of struggle, right? So have hope. So by looking at what's happening around the prophet at the time, and then you can then see the verses that are being revealed are very context related.
I think it's really interesting that it's a perfect example of one of those books that's come about because the author has gone, right, this doesn't exist and I need it, so I'm going to do it myself. Yeah. I think some of the best fiction or non-fiction or whatever, it always comes out of an author has recognized that there is something that doesn't exist in the world and they have to create it themselves. It does sound really innovative.
Yeah, and the idea of the 24-hour clock to help us digest it, because I've seen this done, you've seen it done with the whole history of time and where mankind comes in, and it just helps give our simple brains some perspective as to when things happened and the order of things. Just makes it a little bit more easily digestible.
Yeah.
Who do you think should read this book?
Well, I would say that every single Islamic Studies department in Dubai should be ordering this book right now if they haven't already ordered it, because I think the kids will feel a lot more energized when they go into those classes. I know my kids would have felt that. They're 17 and 15, so they're a bit past that age now. So I think certainly as a secondary textbook for schools, 100%. I think for anyone who is not familiar with the life of the Prophet, it's a very accessible read.
Would this be your go-to now?
Yeah, and so what I would do is I now, when I want to read The Life of the Prophet, I read this, and then if I want to go off and read something a bit more deeper, I've got access to other books. But as a initial start, I'd always go to this.
And what's the third book? We're going in a different direction now, aren't we?
Yeah, we are. And the third book is Just Mercy by Brian Stevenson.
I've never heard of this, but
a clever choice.
It is a very clever choice. Mm-hmm. It sounds brilliant. Please describe what this is about. It's nonfiction, isn't it?
It's nonfiction, that's right. So Brian Stevenson is an American lawyer, social justice advocate, and he's from Alabama in the southern state of America. And he's been, for the last sort of 40-odd years, been challenging injustice against the poor, minorities in the criminal justice system in the US. Just to give you a bit of context here, so the prison population in America in the 1970s was around 300,000 people. Today, it's about 2.3 million people. Every person born in America since 2001, 1 in 15 of every person born in 2001 will spend some time in prison. And 1 in every 3 black male babies born in this century is expected to spend time in prison.
One in three. That's incredible. Okay.
So Brian Stevenson has spent sort of decades representing abused and neglected children who were prosecuted as adults, and then they were incarcerated and then suffered more mistreatment while spending time in adult prisons. He's represented women whose numbers have increased 640% in U.S. jails in the last 30 years. Okay, he's represented mentally disabled people who were put in jail for things they didn't even know, what they had done, really. And he's just represented such a diverse group of people who really had no one to help them, to support them. And it's happened all at the same time when, if you look at the prison building a program, I think in the 80s they were spending about $7 billion a year on building prisons. Now in the US they're spending about $80 billion a year on building prisons. So clearly at the same time corporations have been pushing prison building through with legislators who've been toughening up laws and then essentially just locking up people who you would never lock up, and locking them up in solitary confinement, locking them up in really dangerous conditions. And Brian Stevenson has been working in this field, and this book is really captures that moment from when he was initially a pro bono lawyer in 1983, the first time he went on to meet someone in death row, up to 2014, and all the cases that he's come across. And there were so many times in this book I was reading it and I was literally just crying. I was on the plane one time and the guy next to me said, "Are you okay?" I said, I'm fine, I'm just reading something really emotional. I was literally weeping so many times.
I think this book comes at a really good time, actually, because don't you think this is something that's really in the collective conscious at the moment? Because
Absolutely.
There's so much, well, people are more politically engaged, so, and we're hearing more in the news about problems with the legal system,
yeah.
particularly in the States, but and which I assume is what he's focusing on in this. And there are so many documentaries now about problems, things that have gone wrong, movements such as the Innocence Project.
Yeah.
So I think this is going to be very interesting for people. I know that it caught my attention straight away.
I feel like there are even more fictional stories that have happened in the last decade as well. So things like Orange is the New Black, mm-hmm. Prison Break. Yeah. It's actually more popular across the board as a discussion point.
What's so great is this is a good news story, because you hear so much about what's wrong and what continues to be wrong and is not being fixed. And here is somebody who's actually trying to do something about it.
Yeah, and has done so. And, you know, John Grisham, as we know, who's a famous writer, often with legal thrillers like The Pelican Brief and The Firm. You know, he says, you know, Bryan Stevenson is the real Atticus Finch, and Atticus Finch obviously being, you know, from To Kill a Mockingbird, and praises him greatly.
I think that's kind of the highest praise that you could give
Absolutely.
A lawyer.
I did look at some of the reviews, and even Desmond Tutu yeah. has given his review on this book, saying he is America's young Nelson Mandela, a brilliant lawyer fighting with courage and conviction to guarantee justice for all.
Yeah, and there's some really good TED Talks and good podcasts by Bryan Stevenson as well. So you can, you know, readers can look at that as well.
Is there a bit that you could read out for us?
Yeah, I can, yes. So let me read something. I'll just read two short paragraphs. And now he's talking about, when he talks about proximity, he's talking about proximity to people who've been incarcerated unjustly. So he says, "Proximity has taught me some basic and humbling truths, including this vital lesson. Each of us is more than the worst thing we've ever done. My work with the poor and the incarcerated has persuaded me that the opposite of poverty is not wealth. The opposite of poverty is justice. Finally, I've come to believe that the true measure of our commitment to justice, the character of our society, our commitment to the rule of law, fairness, and equality cannot be measured by how we treat the rich and powerful, the privileged, and the respected among us. The true measure of our character is how we treat the poor, the disfavored, the accused, the incarcerated, and the condemned."
So good. And you have such a great reading voice, Rehan. I could listen to you reading excerpts.
Oh, I got chills from that. Okay. So Just Mercy by Bryan Stevenson was the excerpt, was the book that was being read from. I think I got that the right way around.
You did.
And I think I can already see, but I mean, explain why to you this is the perfect Ramadan read.
Well, look, so as we just read in that quote, Bryan Stevenson says that the true measure and true character of a society is how they treat the underprivileged, the people who are, you know, less well off than us. And I think all of us are guilty at times in life, many times in life perhaps, when we're looking to people who are better off than us, who have more material wealth than us, who have more fame and more status, and we think, oh, I wish I could be like that. And we're always looking up. And, you know, we know that if you're always doing that, you're going to get depressed, right? You'll end up in Prozac or something. But if you look to people who are less well off than you, and you reach down and you help uplift them, you know, you lift them up, then you will feel tremendously satisfied. You'll have a sense of contentment. And you'd have done something amazing for society. And so, you know, Ramadan is that period to look towards people who are, you know, not so well off than you. Now, that could be someone, you're materially not well off than you. Maybe someone in the street and you help them out. It could be someone, you know, who's going through some, you know, mental illness right now. And they just need a kind word, an arm around their shoulder. It could be someone who's just lost their job, you know, and they're feeling really, you know, they're in a difficult time right now. So this is the period in Ramadan where we've got to practice that. And, you know, until we practice that ourselves, there's no way we can carry it on throughout the year. So I think, you know, Ramadan is that period. Let's practice that. And then it becomes second nature throughout the year.
I read something so interesting recently about, and you touched on mental health there, and how people are always being asked to reach out. And this person was saying, actually, we need more people to reach in. because at that moment is actually the time where you're not able to ask for the help that you need. Yeah. So I think that's a really nice thought to leave us with on that one.
And it's topical considering the news that we've had this week for a lot of people. Mm. So there is a poem that I know that you want to read to kind of sum up your Ramadan read today. A little bit of background and before you read it.
Yeah, so it's a poem by Rumi, who obviously we couldn't go very far with, you know, on a program like this without reading something from Rumi. And I think, Annabelle, I think, and Julian, that, you know, life is made of moments, right? And each moment is an opportunity. Okay, and so I think it's a great opportunity to read this poem from Rumi in Ramadan and reflect on it. So I'll just go straight into it if I may. Do not despair, my soul, for hope has manifested itself, and hope of every soul has arrived from the unseen. Do not despair, though Mary has gone from your hands, for that light which drew Jesus to heaven has come. Do not despair, my soul, in the darkness of this prison, for that King who redeemed Joseph from prison has come. Jacob has come forth from the veil of occlusion. Joseph, who rent Zuleika's veil, has come. You all through night to dawn have been crying, O Lord, mercy has heard that, O Lord, and has come. O pain which had grown old, rejoice, for the cure has come. O fastened lock, open, for the key has come. You who have abstained fasting from the table on high, break your fast with joy, for the first day of the feast has come. Keep silence, for by virtue of the command be, that silence of bewilderment has augmented beyond all speech.
Wow, that's beautiful. Thank you so much for reading that. I think that's a perfect way to conclude the segment. Thank you, Rehan, for joining us for Reading for Ramadan. It's the final Reading for Ramadan segment because it will no longer be Ramadan next Saturday.
That's right.